destroying the entire universe.
Welcome to Radio Free Deimos, an Ix and Draconis fan podcast broadcasting from Asaph Hall at Lake Voltaire on Deimos. Deimos, if your home was a dusty rock with no atmosphere, it'd be just like home. This week is host chatter, so we'll take this moment to get to know our hosts. Guys, it's been 8 weeks.
Oh, a while.
It's been a few days, at least a few hours. Like 364 Deimos weeks since we last sat down and recorded something. So what'd y'all guys do on your spring break? I took a trip back home to Kafka 6, the literary penal colony for 20th century literature majors. It's our annual read each other's first novels and critique them writing workshop. And it's really an ordeal. So I'm glad to be back on this desolate rock. Guys, I love you. Don't make me read your novels.
Well, it's been a while since I've been a student, so I kind of work, because that's what I do. Sorry.
It's every day's an adventure, isn't it?
Well, I can say as the story I was just telling Ashtar, over break I discovered that the reply address on someone's email and their drag name are not necessarily the same thing.
You want to elaborate on that at all? Or?
No.
We're not elaborating on that one. So this week we have a submission from Calgren, one of the members of the HSD Discord community, talking about planetary rotation and chronology. A little later on, we're going to work with Calgren on a history episode, so I'm excited to get this piece from him. After that, we have a question from the greater HSD community, which is, can my player characters sell stuff they find?
And we have opinions.
At least one opinion.
Line suck.
At least two opinions.
At least one relevant opinion.
Oh, those.
It's been a while. From the What's New from HSD, we have back on March 7th a Tumblr post about the upcoming lore book. Half of it was an excerpt about a class for teaching birds how to fly, which was fun. And the other half, which was much more exciting to me, was the hypothetical table of contents for the upcoming lore book, and I have to say I'm very excited by it. Over the course of the last 2 months, I've found some fun little spoilers in the author's tabletop game and some of the other posts, so I'm really looking forward to talking about this one.
So is the second half of the story about teaching birds to fly a related story about teaching scavengers how to stand under a nest where birds are learning to fly?
It's Marsco. We're getting on towards second ed, and the resurrection rules are going to be a lot easier, so sad to say no.
Sad for scavengers.
And then a little bit about what's really cool and awesome this week, and a visit to our ongoing HSD campaign.
How can any race be so stupid?
Ah, don't ask me any questions. I'm just a hard hand just like you.
So we'll start with questions and opinions. This week's question, which was not specifically directed to us, but I stole it, was from Athlon on the Discord community, who kicked off a fairly long discussion on that community and I think in our community with the question, a member of my party wants to sell equipment. How does that work? I'd like to ask what the obstacles are, how we can make it work, and if HSD lends itself to a secondhand resale economy. Do you all just want to say no right now? I mean, I think that's the dominant thrust of the game.
It kind of depends where you are and what you're talking about. I mean, is everything 3D printed? I mean, are you going to 3D print gravel for a driveway?
Yes.
Well, you probably just 3D print the driveway and work from there.
It's cheaper than hiring someone to go break rocks with a sledgehammer.
You could print someone to break rocks with a sledgehammer.
You don't 3D print people.
Actually, you do. Actually, whose phone just went off? Actually, you do. There are rules for 3D printing blips. So sorry.
No, seriously, people 3D print rock?
You know, I don't know. I think it's kind of a question of where you put the sliders in your personal game. And I want to say that a lot of bulk goods like gravel and granola and toilet paper probably aren't printed at the buy spot 3 feet away from you. Those probably get shipped in from like the center of the corp town, or gravel might actually be excavated rather than going through the process of making and shipping magic paste number 4.
And I'm going to give you a little bit an advanced look on how I view HSD economies when I disagree.
Okay.
I'm going to say it is cheaper to transport the processed raw material and then 3D print the gravel to your exacting specifications than it is to go dig it up and transport the gravel itself, which is bulky and heavy, wherever you want.
Hmm. Although Mars is mostly gravel from what we've seen.
It's terraformed.
Mars was mostly gravel. Now it's mostly lawn.
And we had giant 3D printers that ate all the gravel and compressed it down into the little tubes of rock that we then feed into our 3D printer and print out
gravel.
You know, custom gravel, designer gravel, artesian gravel.
This is how Rome fell. Y'all may not remember Rome, but it fell, I understand.
Well, I mean, I guess it depends where you are. I mean, if you have massive forests, then wood might actually be kind of affordable and plentiful. I mean, if you're on a mining colony, then rock and ore, you might have just tons of them lying around. Whereas clearly, if you're in a space station and you need something, you probably just want to print it because you don't have local sources of anything except fine local vacuum.
Which we can sell here, by the way. We have a good supply of it.
Sure.
Natural grown wood is just ripe with imperfections.
That's what makes it expensive.
3 foot tall Martian wood weevils. So I think what you're saying is that location is going to be really important. If your PCs are getting into the resale market, mm-hmm. you have a good chance of buying low and selling high if you're taking it to a Blue Sky or a space station or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I'd be inclined to agree. I don't think you can ever like pick up a thing from a dungeon on Venus and take it back to Mars and sell it as a profit. Frankly, I don't think you can ever sell anything at a profit.
Also, what does license for water cost? And when it runs out, what does it melt into?
Honestly, water is probably going to be one of the most expensive raw materials that you have.
Because it's heavy.
It's heavy, it's bulky, it takes up a lot of space, it's hard to transport, it has a lot of mass to it. Mm-hmm. And you can't 3D print water. You cannot 3D print water. Water in its purest form is something that you just have to transport and kind of have to have to live.
It's magic paste number 1.
Most of what you're going to be doing with it is grabbing like ice asteroids and slinging those out to different people. And then mm-hmm. once it gets there, you melt it and purify it and have water again.
Put it in drinks.
Still.
Okay.
Well, in D&D, you had the art objects category of loot, and that was lovely golden rings and paintings of the former king and fur-lined tapestries and gem-studded barbarian loincloths. I don't know. But these were things that had maybe little or no intrinsic value, but they were beautiful, except for the studded loincloth, and had some value to collectors that was in the high GP range, more so than just a rock or a sword might have value.
Just this kind of a tangent, but related to the notion of 3D printing everything, 3D printing your gravel to your own specifications. I don't remember the author, but there's a science fiction book called Queen of Angles. It takes place in a moderate near future, but at one point a character is waiting in someone's office, and the office is completely done up in wood. Now the guy knows this is all fake wood. No sane person would use actual wood, but he's creeped out by it. Because even though he knows it's totally, it's plastic made to look exactly like wood, the notion of making something look just like dead animal bones really disturbs him in a world where that is an affectation. Interesting thought. I don't know if the few hundred years it's passed since Earth culture has made this culture totally divorced from what made objects look like. But a reasonable question would be like, you know, even if you can make perfect fake leather, would you want to? That might be retro. On the other hand, it might be a great way to annoy your folks, especially if you're a cow.
You're now talking to a slightly different market. If you can make everything out of plastic, and plastic is superior in every quantifiable way uh-huh. to any other material that you have, harder than steel, harder than most metals, flexible, doesn't burn, doesn't melt. Take your pick. Why would you want stone or steel or wood at any point?
I really have a hard time letting go of the value of an artisanally crafted thing. I don't want to believe that even in 2750, we're going to not want to have a handcrafted scarf from the street vendor on the corner.
Agreed. You're talking two different markets, though. Just to be clear. Because the construction, the consumer market, the type of thing that you need this to this specification doesn't necessarily have to be pretty. So that's the part that's instantly going to shed wood, steel. It's going to use whoever's cheapest and whoever fits best.
So that's the bulk supply market sort of thing.
The bulk supply or the common print run, whatever. If you're going to make 100,000 two-room family cubicles, you're not going to get fancy with it. You're just going to bulk print those out.
Although imagine how high people's standards could be for customization. I mean, even in crappy planned communities in 20th century Earth, they've got the 15 different choices of bricks, what color your roof is, and people insist on that. I mean, imagine if you could really choose even the texture of your wall, the shape of your doorway, and there would be no technological reason for them to look the same from house to house. Just how crazy people might go with that.
No, absolutely. The structure of the apartments that basically get picked up and moved between buildings is just Mars Coast standard. Mm-hmm. What you fill inside of that, sky's the limit. 3D printer is the limit.
Hmm. Well, I think we're kind of getting away from the thrust of the original question, which is, let's just kind of boil it down. I think we're getting away from the central thrust of the question. The PCs find a rifle when they're on their campaign. It's something the corp wasn't selling them. It's just something they locate from a source, possibly a no longer living source. Can they sell that rifle at a reasonable profit?
Possibly a recently deceased at the party's hands source. Unnamed, of course.
Let's not assume that. That'd be rude.
So to answer that question, why would I want a rifle that's been who knows where, treated who knows how by who knows who, when I could just go to a buy spot and print out a new one for a very reasonable amount?
Well, yeah, you wouldn't get rifle bugs. That would be good. So,
or the stink of somebody who died as the previous owner.
I mean, if the previous owner died, then the rifle didn't exactly save their life.
Yeah.
Am I going to trust it with mine?
Okay, so problem one with reselling loots is that we are in an economy that can print things at not terribly expensive prices. Now, in second ed, the price of a gun is going to go up a substantial amount, and not all characters have the same amount of coins in their back pocket. So I think as a general rule, we can say it's hard to resell things because they're cheap to produce in this future world. There are probably exceptions, and finding those exceptions is going to be a plot point for PCs.
Well, another question is, if you do find something, how do you find out what the license is on it? I mean, do all items have a label on them saying this product was licensed to Fred and will melt in 3 days?
So, point of clarification, if we're talking about the core rules right now, That concept doesn't necessarily exist. There is an add-on that you can get for most items, a PID lock, PID lock, and that runs, what, 10 credits, I believe?
Yeah, 10 credits.
So 10 credits, that's going to be the physical DRM device that locks it to one person.
Okay.
Which is generally assumed to only apply to weapons, although I think that certain game masters who are sadistic apply it to more than that category.
Hi.
Oh, the pillow isn't coded to me. I'm so sad.
See, and this is where we take a bit of a detour from the original question, which is why I didn't quite want to go too far down that rabbit hole. I'll happily talk about it a little bit later when we're talking about our game. But if you find a rifle and it has a PID lock on it, the resale value is going to be pretty much nothing. No one else can use it. The only real use of that rifle is to sell it back to the owner or break it down for raw materials.
Yeah, those things are supposed to be pretty much unhackable, like story level unhackable. The game master may choose to change that quality somewhat, but the assumption is they can't be hacked.
But how do you know if you find a rifle lying on the ground? How do you know if this is a locked rifle or not, except by picking it up and seeing if it melts or not?
I assume it'd have like a big red slash sign on the side, or there wouldn't be as much of a point. I mean, the PID lock is going to disincentivize crooks as well as preventing them from working the thing in the first place.
Okay, right.
You might also see it on your heads-up display in a different color or something like that if you have such a thing.
Quick, aim at that licensing logo behind the tree.
But again, the value of that rifle then becomes Okay, let's assume that the rifle does not have a lock on it. The value of the rifle really depends on the buyer, of course. This is just standard economics. Sure. If you're in somewhere that has a buy spot available, the value of that rifle is probably never going to exceed what the value of a brand new one was going to be,
which is
fairly trivial. I don't think that there's any particular hard and fast rules around selling equipment. Certainly not the same way that D&D 4th edition had.
No, I did some searching through the book, and the word sell does not actually occur in any sense of selling equipment that you find on the ground. It's just not there.
I would assume that in a society with a very advanced 3D printing economy and infrastructure, it would have an equally advanced recycling and breakdown concept.
So you might get your deposit back.
You might get a nominal 5 cents for breaking down your rifle to raw materials for returning said raw materials. Or it may be written into the contract of the terms of service of usage of the rifle. Raw materials revert to the corporation upon breakdown. Whatever.
D&D 4th Ed had something that I've come to think of as the law of equipment thermodynamics. No matter what happens, you're going to receive substantially less than you pay for something, usually on the order of like 1/5 value. And I think that's matches what I know about modern retail. You're never going to be able to sell things at a markup unless you decide to become a store, in which case you're not a PC anymore.
Unless you find a place where there's not a buy spot nearby.
Yeah, Ganymede and like Outback Venus, I think both have high potential for being able to resell things.
Most places in space.
Or the rates selling guns to people who are surrounded by people who want to mug them, you probably could get a very good price.
Timing.
Yeah.
So obstacle two would be the PID lock, which is probably going to apply to any sophisticated piece of electronics, particularly any computer that's owned by a hacker type character. Most major weapons that are unusual at all, most living armor, most powered armor, all that stuff is fairly likely to be locked unless the game master decides it's not for your convenience. Mm-hmm. And then you're probably not going to let it go because you don't get weapons that often.
I would argue against a couple of those, if only because the PID lock doesn't really make sense on like living armor. That's probably just incorporated into the armor. It's going to eat you if it doesn't recognize you.
Ouch.
And some of the more advanced computers are probably going to have different systems or that kind of system just built in. But on the whole, I very much agree. Anything that exceeds a certain value, and you could probably peg that at about maybe 100 credits, maybe, which is about 10% value, would then be the additional security layer on it.
One thing we can look forward to in HSD 2.0 is there are more rules for salvage material. I think there's a reward category that's just materials or stuff. So that's kind of in the future of the game. But also the second edition doesn't have the economy stat. It doesn't have the ledger stat. So its economic system and its reward system is going to be fundamentally different from what we're used to right now.
When you don't have a walking investment portfolio, you do kind of have to get your money, you know, by working like the rest of us plebes. Mm-hmm. Now, that being said, that answers a fairly limited how much is loot worth response. So you were talking about a weapon or maybe a piece of armor, both fairly advanced, fairly specialized. You're not going to find that just smash a barrel, get a rifle. That's not quite how that's intended to work. That doesn't fulfill kind of the believability of the universe.
All my simulation training lied to me.
The follow-up question to that is, well, what is appropriate loot to be dropping during a contract or during a dungeon run, as it were? And some of the immediate things that you can find, you're not going to find just a pile of credits lying around. Oh. That makes just as much sense as finding a pile of bitcoins lying around.
They don't physically exist anymore. We don't know that. There might be plastic cards, but...
So, I believe somewhere within the lore, you can find credit chips. That seems something that's pretty common. You might find a credit chip with, I don't know, someone's leftover lunch money on it or what have you, that can then be hooked back into the system and redeemed.
This would be like a year 2750 gift card, basically, something that's not tied to someone's accounts. It's just a transaction unit.
Hopefully by this time, the gift card has not self-devoured its entire value.
3 weeks.
Yeah, actually, I hear Pulse was founded on the vast amount of money on leftover, on unredeemed gift cards that accumulated by me. I was trying to go for a joke there. You see what it was.
that one's going to loop a reel.
Okay.
But we will save it.
Sure. Thank you.
Another very common loot drop would just be raw materials. Canisters of raw materials, canisters of rare raw materials can be small portable things that PCs can pick up, especially if they're dealing with a vehicle or have a spaceship. Cargo is valuable. You don't even have to define what it is.
Because you can't print gold out of rock.
Yeah, maybe magic paste number 5 with extra copper could be really useful.
Exactly. Or it could be complex hydrocarbon goo.
But you don't find
that just lying around.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, is that just because you have a buy spot with raw materials, unless it can create any element at once, and now platinum, gold, and plutonium have the same value as hydrogen per weight, you might not be able to print certain things.
See, and now you're not talking about 3D printers anymore. You're talking about replicators. Replicators right. Now work on an energy market. The only thing that a replicator cares about is how much energy do you have available. If you have enough energy, you can create whatever physical matter you want. But we're not quite to Star Trek yet. Right. So
I'd say we're about as close to Star Trek on this regard as the Game Master wants us to be, because the technology behind the buy spots really hasn't been defined yet. It's probably not a replicator.
That's true. I like to hold the 3D printer as kind of the idea. We can go to a very advanced 3D printer, but at a very basic level, the transfer and the trade in raw materials is still required for a 3D printer to be a 3D printer. I think if we were actually talking about energy to matter transporter type technology, it would have just been called a replicator and been done with it.
Yeah.
So back to what you were starting to say, what are things you could legitimately loot and salvage?
So raw materials are a very common one. They may not be a super valuable one, but they're very common. You could pick them up. You can have that little, well, my backpack can only carry 3 canisters of elemental iron. What am I going to do with this elemental gold? You know, we have weight capacity. Everybody loves weight capacity in an RPG. You can also use common consumables. We can pretty much assume that anything that does not value worth having a PID attached to it, it's probably something that's just open use. So repair kits, very commonly thrown about, commonly strewn about. It's kind of a standard emergency type thing to have. And the PCs, who are probably getting shot up a lot and have their armor getting hit, would appreciate the repair kits.
Sure.
What's the slap pack or the medicinal thing?
I don't think that's a consumable, though. I would have to double check that one.
Ammo, of course, that's a pretty standard one. And you do find that in crates when you break them open.
Absolutely. Clips are going to be one of the go-to common consumables that you can drop everywhere and that everyone can use.
So that's an interesting point. So if someone's coded expensive gold computer watch melts, do you now have a whole bunch of melted gold raw materials? That seems to be the case.
I don't know how much that would be. I mean, if it's a little thing, but...
Similar to how I don't think the rules have really addressed how the recycling part of the economy of the ecosystem there works.
Yeah.
It also doesn't necessarily have a, call it a remote recycling. You can't walk around with like a material vacuum and vacuum up all of the melted bits and have it sort out into different raw materials. Uh-huh. I mean, you can, and there's probably people that do exactly that, but there aren't rules for it at the moment.
I kind of feel like you're not going to ever hit the Victorian scavenger level of poverty in this setting when you can just kind of sit back on your couch and maintain the status quo. Desperation labor probably doesn't happen in HSD very often.
So they don't have old men on the streets running hand-cranked centrifuges.
Another consumable that's kind of fun is the Pokeball. That's not what it's called. The spontaneous assembly machine.
Oh, the one-use
thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
A flash mob?
Yes, a flash mob. No, it's a ball and you like pull a trigger or say, I choose you and throw it. And it breaks open and creates an item, a fairly large item, like 15 feet or so. It's never going to be like electronic, or you can't do a car, but you could do like a stepladder or something like that.
Can you do a 10-foot pole?
You can absolutely do a 10-foot pole.
Every adventurer needs a 10-foot pole.
You could probably do like a bronze statue of Hodor or whatever you want to do.
And 50 feet of rope.
Could you have it create a 15-foot across grenade?
I don't know. Probably not. The Game Master says no.
Okay. So that one's a little bit
more transparent.
Again, if we're going to use the language of D&D 4th edition, that isn't treasure, that is items. And as an item, it becomes a little bit more question of what's the value of it. Whereas if you look at things that are more treasure, closer to currency, closer to just pure trade value, there is not a use for it. You're just going to turn it back in for credits at some future point in time.
So yeah, that's not salvage again. That's just equipment.
Yeah.
Okay. So things that can be legitimately salvaged, I would say almost anything that was created with the crafting skill could be salvaged.
I'm not sure you would necessarily easily turn that back into cash value. I would want at least a few back and forth RP type things to sell that off, because you're dealing with something that's just not in the catalog.
Well, and I think this entire conversation is predicated on like getting more than 10% of the value of the thing. So absolutely, if you're going to resell this at a profit, if you're going to make any sort of meaningful money at all, you're going to have a good buyer, a corp agent that works with you, an agent of some sort, your Mr. Jones. But something that's made with a crafting skill is probably unique-ish. It likely doesn't have blueprints made of it yet, and it's more or less likely to be a rare item that hasn't been broadly produced at this point in time.
Well, yeah, you can only make four of them before it's economically unviable.
We had an argument yesterday about the value of blueprints. We went in a very large circle for about 45 minutes. That's one thing. Items that have not yet been mass produced by a corporation, whether that's a heavily modded weapon, whether that's an item that was uniquely crafted using the crafting rules, those are all things that could legitimately be sold at a fair gain.
Okay.
Again, maybe. And here's where the other side of that comes in. You have to have someone to buy it. And that means you have to have someone that understands what it is and can put a value on it. And in the hyper-connected world that we have, where everybody is linked instantly to eBay or Amazon, and any item that you bring them, we don't have pawn shops anymore. No one is going to look at an item and go, well, this looks like something, something, something from something, something, something. And 15 years ago, John F. Kennedy made three of these on a custom mill. And you can see that this one has a chip on this. We don't have Antique Roadshow. We don't have Pawn Stars. We have someone that goes, is this in the catalog? Yes. Okay, here's your value.
No, I refuse to believe that there's no magic item shop in this universe.
I'm saying that the bulk of the shopkeepers,
yes,
the bulk of the shops that you're looking at, and when I say the bulk of the shops, I mean pretty much everything that's going to be operating at any standard commercial level is going to be cataloged. Like, they're going to want to scan your item and they will tell you what the computer assigned value is. And if it's not in the catalog, most shopkeepers will have simply lost the skill to appraise what this value is worth. You're going to have to find someone who is specialized in assessing items that are off catalog.
What kind of art dealers?
Right.
Well, even the Antiques Roadshow can't appraise something that doesn't have another version of the same thing to compare it to.
Mm-hmm. Right. True.
And that's actually kind of my point. It's not so much of, okay, well, we'll get back to town and go figure out what this is worth. It's, we'll get back to town and we'll figure out how far we're going to have to go to find someone who might be interested in it. Uh-huh. Or we'll just go show it off to the local thug and show him how it goes bang, bang, really prettily and quote him a price. Mm-hmm.
So less ambiguously, an item that's somewhat tied to a corporation, let's say the Cool Bloom Indicator, which is only a TTI product, generally speaking, something like that lying around, I think would retain a substantial portion of its cost simply because most people will never be able to access one. Again, assuming you can find a buyer, but that you can kind of predicate this entire conversation on that.
And assuming that you're willing to run the risk of TTI taking an interest in this non-TTI sanctioned sale and possession of something that they keep a very tight control over.
Uh-huh. Yeah, a good GM is going to leap on any of this stuff as being, you know, adventure fodder, and that's fine. One piece of salvage that I think would be a lot of fun is a vehicle. I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to find, a vehicle that won't melt down. They exist. I know they exist. I'm sure that IRPF uses them. A non-recyclable car would be a real, I was going to say a real coup. I'll stick with it. Luxury food item type stuff, like whatever the equivalent of like saffron or cloves might be.
So now you're getting back into the luxury goods. And even in something like Star Trek, there's still luxury goods that exist.
Gold-pressed latinum.
Bingo. Presumably, there's a reason why a replicator can't just spit out bars of
tea.
tea.
We know replicators can't handle tea.
So that becomes a little bit more exaggerated when you're dealing with a 3D printer, which does not have the same finesse of a replicator. You are still limited by your raw materials and just how finely tuned that a 3D printer can put stuff together. Now we're going to reach way back to the very first question that you posed out of here. If our Dungeon Michelangelo oil painting that we've picked up in the last foray comes to light, part of the value there is that Dungeon Michelangelo spent maybe 20 years of his life developing his artistry, developing his mastery of the oil form to make the pigments that people have never seen before, combining these all in his masterpiece oil paintings that we can then go back into town and trade off for a quarter of the value of this third magic dagger plus one that we found in the pile. If we take this into something that's a little bit more HSD, we take the same oil painting. We take it back to town. Someone does a little matter scanner of it when we aren't looking, and the next time we turn around, there's a guy with five of them sitting in his kiosk trying to sell you one. A little bit of the value loses there, especially if you can look at this and look at the one next to it, and you cannot tell the difference. And if our 3D printers are that good, that really sucks a lot of the value out of these artisan items. There is still value there. There is still exclusivity there. But the burden of proof that this is actually an exclusive item for such, and at this point really just becomes conspicuous consumption,
and
it's a high bar.
Rich people are never gullible. So again, we're dealing with another kind of set of sliders on your campaign, how efficient the printing technology is, how mercenary the people with their handheld digital scanners are. A lot of these unanswerable questions. I think that there is not a resale market on Mars, at least like in like heavily urban Mars. You may have trouble there. But if you went out into the fringes of the veil, some of the more expensive and more off-Broadway communities, you might be able to find some buyers that are more interested. Blue Skies probably have that reclusive person with huge glasses that would run a magic shop in D&D normally, but we're not playing D&D anymore.
And if we are strictly looking at the source material that we have, I tend to agree, which is most of the core rule books, core rules present very much a utopia. It does not describe too much in the way of getting away from the 3D printers or the highly commercialized, highly consumerist markets. That type of thing is just not conducive to resale value or for scrap lying around. Everything just becomes recycled, raw materialed, and reused back into selling the new year's new fashion or new version.
If you just happen to be there, quote unquote, when a hot zone goes live, and in this particular instance, the buy spot network gets shut down, you may be able to suddenly sell those guns at a huge markup. Timing. It's all about timing.
Unless one of the two corporations or the third corporation behind that hotspot blackout is already in place with their guns that they're selling and making a pretty penny on.
Well, why can't that be you?
Because you didn't think of it.
Oh, damn. I'm not moving very fast this year.
If you look at some of the more expanded literature, like the softcover book itself, that actually does talk about some of the street gangs or some of the underhighway junkyards that imply that there is a lot more towards areas that are not dystopias, that there are places that you might have junk sitting around that might have a resale or a reuse value. So I don't think that it's fair to say that there is just no salvage value to anything.
Yeah, that book felt like a lower tech version of HSD, not out of the realm of the spectrum of the game, but definitely on the lower ebb of it.
Right. And that kind of then depends on the GM a little bit to decide, where do we fall on the utopia dystopia slider of HSD? Do you stick to really what the core book is describing, which is kind of utopia, but is also kind of sticks a little bit more towards some of the more urbanized areas where you have a concentration of both wealth and people and a buy spot on every corner and a smart glass on every surface type of thing? Or is your campaign really taking place more in some of the fringes to that deeply urbanized setting, whether it's more of the frontier on, say, Venus, which is more lightly settled? Are we talking about some of the space lanes in between major stations? Or are you talking about, for example, some of the lower levels of the stations that are overrun by the criminal organizations or more or less abandoned? All of those, you would have a much more thriving salvage market, salvage economy.
Okay, so location, timing, and taking advantage of other people's circumstances. Yeah.
Slash Yay, capitalism.
Misfortune.
I think we beat that one into the ground. But it's a question that doesn't really have any answers at all. The core rulebook does simply not address this subject one single bit. So I look forward to seeing how it evolves in the next edition, perhaps.
Oh, one final point.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a final point, too. So you have your final point first.
I have the first final point. So there. The other thing that I did not mention is something that I did kind of hit the same thing when I was trying to figure out how to add additional loot or how to add additional rewards for not good behavior, but interesting behavior on dungeons. And one of the other carrots that I found that you can tweak with a little bit is you do have the contract itself. Oftentimes, the PCs are going to be going out and doing something based off a contract. That is kind of the language of how HSD is put together. The contract promises a reward for a job. Do this job, you'll be rewarded with this amount. And that's kind of frameworked within the rules as moderate danger jobs, moderate rewards, a very dangerous job, the reward looks like this.
I feel like you're going to go down the Project Paperclip angle at this point.
Project Paperclip?
Oh, so when the Pentagon would make these huge contracts with massive writers and charge $500 per paperclip?
Ah, yes. No, that's not quite the angle I was going to take. I'm taking the Kickstarter route. The other way that I found to really add a little bit more interest into the contracts was to put in little stretch goals to them. So this is your contract, and it's worth this much. But if you do this in a particularly flashy way, we're going to give you a bonus. If you do this without anyone knowing that we're the ones behind it, you get this bonus.
Okay.
If you do this without killing anyone, we're going to go ahead and double that and give you the real thing that we are promising.
We didn't get any of those bonuses.
Yeah, the party did not actually. Well, the party did get the perform this in a particularly flashy or fabulous way that everybody could see.
That's true. There was a big red button.
That does make it a little bit more interesting. The party can either go for the core objective, which you have to complete to get the first level, to get the core reward, and probably is going to have a pretty high success. Or if they're really feeling jumpy that day, you can start getting a little bit more elaborate and a little bit more kind of reaching, kind of pushing your luck to hit some of the stretch goals. Mm-hmm. Or you can just go for all of the stretch goals right from the get-go, and interesting things are bound to happen.
So my final point, and this is totally not relevant at all to anything we were discussing, except it feels a little, I just want to say it. In the tabletop campaign that Pierce Fraser is running right now, it's on episode 5, I think, the PCs begin the campaign with a donut. And
a donut.
A donut. This fascinated me, and I have blown like 3 hours of state salary time on this concept of HSD donuts.
Sugar or chocolate?
It was a perfect donut.
Maple?
Probably.
Mm.
I think it was jelly-filled, actually. Jelly-filled maple would not work very well for me. Anyway.
There's maple jelly.
So the conversation began with Sev, Pierce Fraser's alt, saying, there's something unusual about this donut. It's off-model. The idea was that donuts are printed from a donut blueprint using, I guess, the Sugarmatic Pastry 2000 Pastron. I don't know. Someone had customized the donut. And then he went on to talk about donut shops for just one beautiful minute, talking about how donut shops individualize themselves by tweaking the blueprints they print to have some minor customizations. And I just got lost in this idea that a donut shop would be like WordPress, where you have high-end sliders on some models where you can delicately control the amount of frosting and what specific ingredients, and maybe you're using the PTML pastry text markup language to code these things on a ingredient by ingredient level and tweaking the spices and the vanilla levels, but it's still templates that build crawlers for your audience. And then someone comes into the room and it picks up their preferences from the previous time they were there with their flavor profile and digitizes a donut for them based on their tweaks to your templates. And I was lost in this concept of this very specific market of pre-printed perfect donuts when I have not successfully made a donut in my life. But it was an interesting window into one of Sev's storefronts in this world, something that's as simultaneously mass-produced but individualized in our world as a donut would be something that a PC would say, hey, this is not Model 45 glazed color. It just amazed me as an idea. You'll see the extended write-up of this. I've got like a page and a half on the pastry markup language already.
Ode to donuts.
Yes.
Well, I can't say that now I want a donut.
We'll print one out soon.
Okay.
Why is it so important that you want to contact the governments of our Earth? Because of death. Because all you of Earth are idiots!
So this week we have our first listener-submitted piece. It's a short segment by listener Colgren from the HSD Discord chat about planetary rotation and campaign chronology. Manimi, would you pull that file up, please?
One thing I keep forgetting about the planets is that they are moving. Sometimes I'll find myself reading through the HSD lore and I'm imagining that Earth and Mars are almost right next to each other, never moving, the whole time everything is happening. But that's not the case. The case is the planets are moving, and that's the reason why it's practically cost ineffective for Earth to wage a war against Mars, a physical war. Almost every 2 years, Earth and Mars are at their closest to each other. I haven't fully calculated it out yet, but I'm working on that. And apparently it's going to be a lot of fun. I love these numbers. It's going to be fun. And I found out something interesting about Pluto and as to why Pluto is not a planet. It is technically not a planet because of its orbit in conjunction with Neptune. About every 248 years, the position of the two planets being furthest from the sun swap. About every 248 years, Pluto becomes closer to the sun than Neptune, and Neptune then becomes the furthest from the sun. Another 248 years later, Neptune is now closer to the sun than Pluto is. So about every 248 years, their positions being furthest from the sun swap. Yeah, there's no need to worry about Pluto colliding with Neptune. Their orbits don't allow for that to happen. At least, not for possibly millions to billions of years. Which I doubt I will ever see that day. Ha ha ha.
So the first response I would have to that is, as I am often one to ruin people's fun, I'm going to let you know, if you enjoy the calculations and the numbers, stop listening for a moment. During my research to put together my game, there were two different places that I found that really helped model. Kerbal Space Program, if you have that game, is a very, very interesting little simulation that really does crazy things. But I believe NASA also has an app online that models where the different planets are, gives you distances, gives you all sorts of celestial information that covers any time point from now to the next, conveniently, 700 years, and then some. If you want to put an actual date to a campaign and find out just for how far away Earth and Mars are at that day or that month, NASA has already figured that out for you. They're a bunch of smart cookies. And I know you can't hear me, but for those of you that closed your ears, you can start listening again now.
I feel like a lot of our campaign, well, I feel like our dominant assumption of the HSD worlds is that the solar system moves at the speed of plot. And that's not factually correct. It's the shorthand that GMs run with. Most travel within the HSD universe takes 2 weeks. Everything takes 2 weeks. You can go across the entire solar system in 2 weeks. I worked out what the speed of plot would be. And I think it's about a tenth of light speed for some journeys. If you like travel from Venus to Jupiter at the speed of plot, you're moving at a substantial portion of the speed of light and would probably arrive older than your friends when you got there. I don't really know where I was going with that sentence.
Or the other way around.
Yeah, or the other way around. So thinking about how planetary orbit affects the game, whether you're going to arrive at Mars's rainy season when you've left Venus at its, Venus doesn't really have seasons, when you left Venus, it's an element of the game that isn't really written into the rulebook and level of complexity that some tables wouldn't find useful, but occasionally a game master might want to invoke when you're dealing with a wartime table or a sense of urgency needs to be invoked. It's an option. It's not an option that tends to be pursued from what I've seen of the game.
It really depends on whether the calendar matters. If you are just running at the speed of plot or running with days at a time that aren't really nailed down, probably doesn't matter that much. If your plot arcs across weeks or months, especially with travel in between, you might want to track that type of stuff a little bit closer.
One thing that Calgren said that kind of hit me almost immediately as being a really apt point is the idea that we see the planets as just fixed in space. And no, factually, I don't think that's true, but I think that's about the level of consideration we give them. Yeah, it would take forever to wage war between Earth and Mars. And practically speaking, there wasn't a war between Earth and Mars in the books. There was just the occasional terrorist act. But operating at sublight speed at the technologies that we had 50 years in the future, how long would the journeys between Mars and Earth have taken in terms of colony setup and resources back and forth and shipping organisms hither and yon?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. A bit longer than that. To put things in context, Calgren and I were sharing a spreadsheet that's the sum timetable of the entire HSD universe and kind of refining our numbers there for some future project. So we were kind of thinking very closely about the way this date folds into this date, folds into this date. And that kind of is the context of this conversation.
I think you can have a war when it takes months or years to get places. I mean, that's happened on Earth. We had, maybe in the 19th century, how long did it take to get from England to India?
2 weeks.
No, it was longer than 2 weeks. Or how long, like during the American War of Independence, how long did it take to cross the Atlantic Ocean? Yeah, I think it took a long time. It's a pain to fight wars when it takes months to get to your destination, but it's not impossible. One thing, of course, I'm thinking about, as I'm never that far from thinking of C.J. Cherry, is in her universe, the wars fought out on the frontier where the information delay between Earth and the frontier where the things were taking place meant that orders were years out of date. Fleets were told to take stations that hadn't existed for half of a decade because Earth didn't know about it yet. And that's in her universe, that's kind of what eventually caused the colonies to break off from Earth as an irrelevance. Though that wouldn't be the case here because there's a good communications network. I mean, the solar system is only, what, 8 hours wide at the speed of light? So while it takes you a long time to get where you're going, I mean, unless you're being very sneaky, people know you're on your way way before you get there.
Yeah, we're dealing with the inner ring for the most part.
Well, we're also not dealing with faster than light travel. That's
right.
That is huge for taking complexity out of a lot of the sci-fi communications.
But do please see next discussion topic. Sorry, I didn't mean to kill that one there.
Well, fine. You win.
Trump card. Anyway, thank you, Calgren.
Boy, how can anything that big hide for so long a time? Yeah. I wonder what their next move will be.
So speaking of time dilation and months between stops on the journey, let's talk about what's new from Ixun Draconis. Back in early March... Okay, so rewind a little bit. The last time we recorded was March 5th or March 6th. We released our last episode on March 7th. And on March 7th, Pierce Fraser posted one of the more exciting Tumblr updates I've seen in quite some time, which was both this article about teaching birds to not fly and the preview spoilers for the lore book itself, both of which were pretty darn neat. So I want to talk first about the classroom session because it's a neat little window. And then go on from there. We'll post a link to the article on our show notes. The scene opens in a classroom filled with birds, or rather members of the AVLF family. The classroom is filled with young birds that haven't gotten their flying licenses yet. And the teacher, Mr. Sannon, is talking to his new students about the difficulties of being an avian, the challenges of flying, which is a skill that not everybody can learn, not even every bird can learn. And I think most importantly, the differences between a vector and a lateral and an honest-to-gosh animal. Birds can fly because they're birds. They were born with an instinctive knowledge of how to flap their wings and go upwards. Vectors were born with the instinctive knowledge of how to form societies and argue things to death on the internet. They're humans. And at heart, this, and that's something that this passage focuses on, is really how human vectors are. Even the laterals are human. They have an advantage because they're born to the shape of a bird and presumably have the musculature of a real life bird, but their heads are still Homo sapiens. And it was a really neat window into this world, both being a scene from an authentic classroom in 2750 and talking a little bit about the tank learning that I'm kind of interested in as a concept right now, and knowing what vectors really don't know. After that, Pierce starts talking more about the lore book itself. He says that it's about 80% done, which means I imagine that we'll be seeing a Kickstarter in the next few months. He's been pretty good about those and has a number of successful ones under his belt at this point. I will certainly chip in my meager paycheck towards that. And then he opens up the table of contents for the lore book, which is super exciting and filled with hints about things that we've been talking about in our little show, things that we have not yet talked about anywhere, and strange alien ideas from the world of Metaplot that will certainly challenge our worldviews going forward. So I'm going to look into this. Let's see, things we've discussed. Chapter 1, the difference between history and fact. Ashtar, I think you've brought this up a number of times.
It sounds familiar.
Yeah, so this is kind of what's known by vectors, what's the truth that the corpse have hidden, perhaps, what's too good to be true. I think we've had a number of conversations about this specific topic. And that's followed up by who knows what and why. I don't know what we're looking at there exactly. Is this knowledge that's hidden from the PCs, or simply the fact that in a universe that's entirely based on controlled information, one cannot fully know everything?
I will be interested to see how that kind of information breakout occurs, or that that's something that's just kind of evenly concentrated at some of the higher corp levels, or if the corps have disparate amounts of information, if certain corps are the information brokers and others are just playing games with giant robots, as it were. So it'll be interesting to see where that lore kind of breakout comes.
The next chapter is called Current Life, and it focuses on a lot of the day-to-day stuff that's kind of behind the scenes in the HSD world.
Of robots.
No, not robots. Oh, Current Life? That's probably like the Robot Fanciers magazine. concepts of perceived scarcity, which is one of the things that drives economic trends in Pierce's world. A chapter on megacorps. Who knows what that could cover? All of society, in fact. Hot zones. I have not seen an awful lot about hot zones, and I really want to talk about them more in the future because I think they're a really important bit of HSD setting that just hasn't been exploded yet.
I'm going to agree with that one. Hot zones are very interesting. They really have a lot of flavor, both in the core of rules and in just, you know, how corporations kind of jostle for power, position, territory, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But there was kind of a miss on actually telling you what they are.
Yeah, it's one paragraph.
It made it really hard as a GM to integrate that as something that worked. Mm-hmm. So
I will totally buy Pierce's reasoning that the book is like 289 pages long and you can't fit everything in it and it's already chock full of goodness. Totally agree with that. But since hot zones are one of the primary methods that corps use to reshape their boundaries, kind of like corporate gerrymandering, I think it's something that desperately needs to be pulled out and examined closely. And it looks like he's going to do it. And I promise we're going to do it. grottos. Grottos in the next version of the Player's Handbook, I think, get a little bit more traction as a place where corporations don't really have a firm foothold. So the space station of your birth winds may be a bigger plot point in 2.0 than it was in 1.0.
Okay.
Because it's not just distant and far flung and populated by hyenas with gassy space cows. It's a place that Marsco doesn't exist necessarily, and that makes it valuable.
That'd be a different sort of world, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
This alters my entire worldview.
Yeah, I was warning you that could happen. A new term, Dark Wars, which is allied with Hot Zones somehow. So I think this is kind of the Shadowrun side of HSD, where PCs engage in more covert operations, and there's shadowy
space ninjas.
Shadowy space ninjas.
Wait, you mean we weren't playing Star Trek, the furry edition?
Then we'd leave the damn solar system.
Yeah, I've heard no reference to any prime directive other than pay the gosh darn bills.
I think your prime directive is don't pay the bills.
True, true.
To evade taxes. The next major set of chapters is focused on the megacorps, and I think we've seen a little of this already. There was the description of the spyglass dark town and the strange religious ravings from TTI. The book's going to go chunk by each of the major megacorps with information on each one, several documents that are going to open up different aspects of the corporation and their world from the inhabitants' point of view, from outsiders' point of view. Super excited by the amount of color this is going to bring to the game. But that said, there is one item on here that is new. It is the 7th megacorp. And I've been twittering occasionally, hashtag what is Lumen? It's Lumen is the newest member at the megacorp table. It's been around for about a year at this point, it sounds like. And this is...
That's what they want you to think.
It's what Pierce wants me to think. And I think it's the first seed of metaplot that we've seen in the game so far. We don't know a lot about Lumen. Characters aren't going to initially have the ability to have Lumen as their background proficiency building slot. They're not going to be trained in Lumen skills. They're probably not going to have Lumen connections right off the bat.
So you're really worth the dark about Lumen. Wag.
That's... You should write the marketing copy. What we do know about Lumen is they burst onto the scene a year ago. There's some past tense, future tense issues there. They burst onto the scene with lots and lots of money, enough to effectively force their way into the megacorp spotlight arena, and are bent on creating disruptive technologies and really shaking things up. I think there's some hints that they're kind of darker and shadier than they may seem. No surprise there. Maybe sort of a space Illuminati thing happening. The only piece of technology that I know of right now, I think there's more in the tabletop sessions that Sev has been hosting. The piece of technology we know that Lumen is using to really shake things up is miniaturization technology for weapons. What this means is that your micro character can have a G.I. Joe sized blaster that will still take down a tank.
Okay.
And that's pretty awesome. And that's what I know about Lumen. They've got the small guns. Someone described the idea of a scalpel sized sword that's got all the punch of a double handed bastard sword. So I'm not sure how this miniaturization technology works. It's definitely magic science.
Let's hope fleas never get it.
No, that'd be terrible. Terrible. Fleas with blasters. After that, we get into some sort of deep magic stuff. There's talk of the Pale Men, the Master's Voice, a section called Lightspeed. I don't know exactly what that means, but in some discussions of the concept of canon doubt and uncertainty I've heard from Pierce over the last few months, he's said that specifically the speed of light is a barrier that vectors haven't broken, even though it's 750 years in the future. And why is that? Is it not achievable, or has it been tried and then other forces have pushed it back? We don't know. But that's, I think, one of those nebulous places where the game master has a lot of leeway. Shadow Presidents get some discussion. Transcendence, something called Nephilim. I don't know what that is. A discussion of legacy memory, which used to be a morphism and will soon be a background trait.
We know something about Nephilim. We had that discussion right up about the doctor that wrote the book that was full of Nephilim.
Oh, that's right. That's where that's from. They're like kind of great old ones, maybe, I think. I have to listen to myself again, which I don't want to do. And then some information about humanity and maybe what's left over from them 700 years in the future. So there is a lot of meat in this book and a lot of things I'm really looking forward to seeing opened up.
Lightspeed is always one of the interesting sci-fi topics. It's kind of a limit of everything in more of the hard sci-fi. You don't have information past it. You don't have any visibility past it. You cannot physically go past it. Nothing really exists past it.
It's kind of like a singularity.
Right. Anytime that you're talking about faster than light speed travel, in general, you're not actually talking about reaching light speed. You're talking about shifting dimensions and coming back further out. You're talking about wormholes that bypass the distance of the plane of existence that you're on. You're talking about, you know, working around light speed limitations, not actually breaking the speed of light. So it'll be interesting to see which approach that HSD is going here.
Well, I think we've seen some of that already in Transcendence, in TTI's ability to fold space and not helpfully teleport people into the deep void. Mm-hmm. This is not technology that we're able to use successfully yet, but it's something that exists. I feel like TTI moves at the speed of entanglement rather than the speed of light.
No, and spot on. Forging space and then punching a hole between two weak points to teleport across or to step through the wormhole across is kind of how wormholes or teleportation can be theorized to work. So that is matching a lot of the language that we already see mirrored in TTI descriptions.
Oh, there's a chapter on owls, too. Maybe we'll play Bull Brace again.
Kill on sight.
It has taken you centuries to even grasp what we developed eons of your years ago.
So having talked about what's new in HSD, I want to talk about what's new from Radio Free Deimos. We've been on an extended little break for the last 2 months, but during that time, we've been making some fun plans. We're going to be in the near future wrapping up our sort of ongoing arc about character creation, and the culmination of that should be a couple of real play sessions with some fun guest hosts. And almost all of us at the Radio Free Deimos table have been game masters at some point in time or another, or are currently game masters. So we'll have a lot of people that are on both sides of the game master screen on this one. I'm looking forward to this as being a fun experiment. I suspect it's not going to be a very serious game, but a playful way of running some. Ashtar is shaking his head right now. You can't see it, but it's true. But a playful way of test driving some new characters, running them through the system, also changing what side of the game master screen I'm on, which I'm looking forward to. It's been a while.
Oot.
We have an opportunity to visit the North American Hyena Sanctuary at some point in time soon and chat with the hosts there about floating space matriarchies. And after that, I'm hoping to have two or three or maybe even four episode sequence on the topic of hot zones and economy, which are both very tightly tied together. One of my oldest friends, game master and writer by the name of Mark Carroll, has really made urban conflict a centerpiece for some of his campaigns. And he's going to be joining us to discuss what exactly a hot zone in Full Meltdown might look like. Had a lot of research on this topic, and I'm super excited to bring this depressing subject into the limelight.
This is the most fantastic story I've ever heard.
And every word of it's true, too.
So our tabletop campaign has also had a series of hiatus, and has been very spotty over the last few months as Wines and I have been struggling with a burdensome level of masochistic self-inflicted convention snafu. But that's mostly in the past right now until it becomes the future again. And we have had perhaps two play sessions over the last few months.
Unfortunately, we have had a run of conflicts.
So at some point in time, you decided to kind of pack up the previous plot arc because we were nearly at a stopping point and there was all these breakpoints, and then start on a new section of story.
There is truth to that, but that is not the whole truth. With many of the arcs, there is always going to be several outs that you can take at any given point. Just because you've taken an out doesn't mean that the arc is completed. Doesn't mean that might not show up as later threats.
Well, completed for now.
Ooh, so mysterious.
No, I think you're making stuff up.
Well, now that we're actually talking about my game or my interpretation on it, going to touch back to what we were talking about earlier with kind of where the economy goes and where rights management
Down a deep hole, I think.
So one of the approaches I took, especially upon reading the core rulebook and really starting to get familiarized with the lore, you've probably heard me reference this a couple of times, is that I really viewed the initial presentation of HSD as kind of utopia. Not entirely. It's got its shadowy points. It's got its darker points. But kind of the core of it was upbeat, idealistic, very things are going right for a lot of people in a lot of different ways without necessarily a special framework that holds. It's just things are going right because people are generally good and corporations are generally good and it's all working out and everyone's making a buck and everyone's happy. That's not quite the spin that I wanted on HSD, though. So I deliberately took it a little bit away from a utopia and tried to focus a little bit on some more of the in-between spots, both in the options that I gave the players to start with, but also in just some of the underlying assumptions that I made. I think I
I was going to say that we picked the framework for kind of a Firefly style game, if I remember correctly. And that does lend itself to a more frontier driven approach.
Exactly. I think I threw like five or six different starts at you. We could probably reference one of our earlier shows where I laid out a bunch of them, but all of them were patterned after different sci-fi universes that are on now. Nothing a direct link, but just kind of lifting the framework of it. So in the Firefly episode, players have a ship. They own it outright. Except it's got a huge loan on it, and they have to kind of pay it back, and so that's going to follow them around.
I just don't think that having a huge loan is the same as owning it outright. I mean, this wasn't in the original.
You did not read the fine print.
There was no fine print.
You did not see the fine print. That doesn't mean there's no fine print.
That's true.
You can't actually see the fine print.
It's really fine. It's nano print.
But that's neither here nor there. It's on the contract. So this is directly relevant to what we were talking about earlier, because I don't necessarily agree with the concept of the PID lock. I don't think that that's necessarily a 10 credit add-on that you're only going to put on certain things. My understanding,
it's like butter. Smear it on.
My understanding, when you're dealing with a group of very large corporations that have an inherent interest in making a profit, keeping their intellectual property secure, because I really see that large corporations are going to be acting a lot more like present day Recording Industry Association or Motion Picture Association. They're going to start introducing what we see, the edges of digital rights management, into pretty much everything. You're not just going to get digital rights management about digital stuff. You're going to get physical rights management. That car that you purchase a license for is going to run for 2 weeks, and then it's going to melt because your license has expired and you do not have the rights to use it anymore. And the way that I really see this economy is, once you get a 3D printer that's efficient enough, products have no intrinsic value. Like, their value is the value of the raw materials used to put them together. But those raw materials are not actually bought or sold either. They're just on loan because, per the contract of your license, once recycled, those raw material rights return to the corporation. Blah, 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 legal stuff here. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I saw your face kind of glaze over. But so anything that you're purchasing, anything that you're using, is probably going to be more of a license-based economy. You have a license to use that rifle. You're not actually buying a rifle. You're buying the rights to use a rifle. The physical rifle that you get, oh, just go print it out somewhere. We don't care. Mm-hmm. But you cannot run an economy like that where you can pirate licenses. You cannot run an economy like that where you could print off two rifles and give one to your friend. It's just, it fundamentally doesn't work. So for that kind of economy to work, you now have to have some sort of control over who's using the rifle, who's using the license, how many people are using. You have to control what you're licensing out, what you're purchasing.
I feel like it's worth pointing out as clarification, this is Ashtar canon and not necessarily rules as written.
This is true. This is why we're in the my game section.
Okay.
Now, the practical effect of this is that, for the most part, anything that is printed out via blueprints or printed out through a 3D printer really is just not resellable at all. You drop it back in the recycler when you're done with it or when the license is up, and someone might give you a 5-cent fee for returning it back to the proper recycling area.
Which really forces the pieces into a service economy.
Right. It enforces a little bit more of a service economy. It focuses that rewards that you're getting are generally going to be things that are just too small to really worry about, which is where I said earlier, the clips and the repair kits. And raw materials become a little bit more useful. But that also underscores a couple of the other things I said. The PC really should never get to a point where it becomes, well, never is a very strong word. Mm-hmm. In the type of game that I think everyone at the table is interested in playing, for my table, I don't think running a trucker service is particularly interesting. I would never want to see the players get excited about the amount of marginal value they can get from carting an asteroid from outer space somewhere to Mars to resell for raw components.
Given that we're like 1,200 credits in the hole right now, I am pretty excited about these things.
Yeah.
You should be more excited about some of the contracts that you could be running that takes much larger chunks out of that.
No, let's just add to our negative. I know how this works. He's shrugging. You can't see him shrug.
I got nothing.
Okay.
The contracts are there. The offers are there. Failure is fun.
True. Absolutely. No, I'm agreeing. Totally. Absolutely. Unironically.
But what I think this does is when I'm approaching a lot of the core stuff, I do have to be very aware that there is rules as written and kind of lore as written. And then my take on it, which is a little bit more Shadowrun, which is a little bit more cyberpunk, which is maybe kind of in that gray area between dystopia and utopia. Don't really have anywhere I was going with that. Just kind of an explanation of some of the flavor.
Well, one challenge we've had, I think, across the like last 6 years we've been gaming together as a table, way before we discovered HSD, is the problem of having PC-driven goals that the party can get behind. One direction the player character started moving in this arc is away from heists and towards
anything else that you're not quite so bad at.
Yeah, absolutely. Which in this case is like 30-foot-long Martian crocodile wrestling and making documentaries without a camera, which we got to be better at than trying to smuggle stolen goods. So that should be fun. This is a direction that I think my PC was kind of really pushing for, but it is a short arc goal that's achievable and is something that our characters dictated rather than the universe provided, which is kind of rare.
It is and it isn't. There are about three different threads that I could say right now that the PCs could tug on and start following down just from character-driven type stuff or things that are just open-ended. But this is the one that's been chosen, and this is what we're looking at, so I'm pretty excited to see how that works. Those crocodiles are much, much larger than all of y'all, so please don't wrestle them. Or do.
No,
you know, whichever.
There's a line item in the contract. If you wrestle them, you get extra money. Gonna have to drug them first.
Please don't wrestle the alligators. But if you do, there's credits for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this will give me a chance to dress up like Crocodile Hunter and Indiana Jones' love child, which will make my character very happy.
Make your character an adorable little snack.
Yes, yes.
Have we had a single arc where your character hasn't been dressed up in something particularly outlandish?
The intro session, which didn't really have any character-driven stuff at all.
No, that was an intro session, so it was a little bit more guided theme park. But you got homicidal AI out of it, so, you know,
yay!
Suicidal and homicidal, or both.
So having been plagued by a series of short sessions and broken up sessions, it's really nice to be able to get back in the swing of the game, and I hope we're playing again this Sunday. We'll find out.
There comes a time in each man's life when he can't even believe his own eyes.
Well, after your description, I don't think I'd want to see it either.
So I think we're starting to run out of game-related topics at this point, so I'm going to want to close with what's awesome this week. Things that the hosts have found that have brightened their weeks, or at least were interestingly depressing. Does anybody want to start?
Pictures of baby aardwolves. That's not only news.
No, they were awfully cute, though.
They're very cute.
Cute little muzzles. Do HSD aardwolves only eat ants?
I don't know. I assume they only like termite flavor.
Well, yeah, you probably like sell like termite smoothies and things like that.
But you can add termite flavor to anything.
Well, unless it's a luxury good, in which case you might have to go on a quest to find termite extract number 14.
Mm-hmm. Ugh. Miniature giant termite steak.
That one's got a really nice leg on it. A termite like this, you don't eat all at once. Okay, aardwolves. There'll be pictures of aardwolves in the show notes.
Sure, good.
From the space technology frontier, we had a couple of successful takeoffs and landings.
Ooh.
So some of our privatized space companies are making some definite strides there. I believe
inroads or uproads?
Both. Okay. And downroads.
Oh.
That don't end in fiery crashes.
Woo.
And I believe NASA came out with some interesting information about what kind of roadmap we're looking at to get to Mars. So
Fearless Leader has said it's a 7-year roadmap.
It's a great roadmap.
Two things for me this week. First off, the podcast Astronomy Cast, which has some good articles that I've found on like Mars terrain and Venus terrain and terraforming and things like that. Very inspirational. Their most recent miniseries has been on launching animals into space and to their death. Cheerful. It's some very sad stories about quail going to their great beyond. Any number of dogs primates and the sad story of what happened after the primates landed. It just goes on and on and on, this litany of things and living creatures we've launched into space, mostly to see how fast they die. And that's that miniseries.
I remember Model Rocketry, they used to, I don't know if they still do it, but their version of that was to build a rocket that can launch and then recover an unbroken egg.
Oh, I thought you were going to say hamster.
A reasonable question would be, in the real world, how many of these were used to launch and recover hamsters? But
the hamster doesn't have to be recovered necessarily. Oh, we're going to get letters.
Yes.
We don't usually get letters. That'll be kind of nice. The other thing I saw was a video and an article about the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a recent project they did to 3D print a building, which is pretty neat and super on topic for Ixundraconis. Rather than having an enclosed box that can hold a building, the 3D printer in question had a robot arm on a wheeled unit, and it would kind of trace around the outside of the space and define it. And it created a domed structure 12 feet high and 50 feet wide that took about 15 hours to produce. And that's, it had an outside wall that was hard plastic lined with foam insulation. I don't think they have an answer for how to print wiring yet. That's not a thing. But they did say that in future launches of this product, they could have the opaque exterior fade seamlessly into the window panes that would let you see outside your geodesic dome printout. And I was just really excited to see this technology moving in a direction that has been presaged by our little game universe. And that's really all I have to say about that. But there was a robot building a building with a 3D printer. Awesome.
A small building.
It was a dome, but it was an example. As long as it was a proof of concept, as long as the thing can fit itself into the space, it can create a 12-foot high building.
Trying to figure out how to work in a reference to Ben Stiller talking about a school for ants, but I can't.
You missed your chance with the termites.
I really did.
Yeah. But I think that's all we have time for after this little hiatus and return to unreality. So thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for catching back up with us, and catchy outro line.
Intro music is Future Club and outro music is Tronicles, both by Sirius Beat. This podcast is copyright 2017 by Radio Free Deimos and may be used in any not-for-profit project with appropriate credit and notification. Check out our website, radiofreedeimos.com, that's DEIMOS, for more rambling, resources, links to official and fan-driven content, and our full catalog of episodes. And look for us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play.
I forget how we usually chronologize episodes. Life goes on.
We do the intro, and then we talk.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's what you do. I have a plan. Okay, so I'm feeling like an idiot, too. Can we be idiots together?
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
Go for it.
Two little things for me. They're both fairly brief.
It's going to be a great roadmap, and we're going to make the Martians pay for it.
I am totally leaving that one in the blooper reel.